We're going to call to order the meeting of the Shellfish Management Advisory Committee. It's 4:08, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to Jim. We've got two agenda items that we're going to go over, I think. One is the 2015 Oyster Replenishment Plan, and the other one is a discussion on harvest effort control. Jim?
Every year we have to get approval of the replenishment plan for the year, and thing that we ask for the commission that we have special procurement procedures that we can do as a commission that the rest of the state cannot do. It's in our code section. So we have the same amount of money we had last year, $2 million from the General Assembly, and that will be mostly for use, all be used for Shell, and then we have a few other pots of money for other things, and that's we're doing a little bit of seed, and for doing these seed projects, we're using the user fee monies from the Blackman Waterman, putting 10,000 bushels in Nomina and the Cone this year, and last year we did the Yocomico. This year we're moving down the Cone with James River seed is a little bit more risky, but it seems like the oysters have been living, so at least going to try half of them there. It is expensive. It's $8.50 a bushel to get seed up there from the James. Also doing, we set aside one rock in the Courtauld River. It was in Area 4, the rotation area, for some years, but it often gets a spat set, but it often also gets an anoxic event that kills the oyster. So it seemed better to try it for a while to actually use it to get some seed for especially Area 6 that, like, people went to this year and there wasn't anything there because we never get a spat set in Area 6. So we're going to move 5,000 bushels from the Courtauld River on that rock over to Area 6 to kind of get a few oysters in there to catch for 3 years from now. We have the possibility of moving some seed in the Great Wicomico. The Corps of Engineers has a project there that they're going to refurbish some of their reefs. Mm-hmm. And they've bid it out twice, and it has come in too expensive for them to afford the shell planting they want to do. And they also had part of it that they were going to clean the oysters off of it and move them around in the river, but they kind of gave up on the cleaning off. So they came back and said they were just going to cover up the oysters that were there on these reefs, so it was okay with them that we actually moved that the little bit of seed that's there away, and we think it's about 10,000 bushels of seed that we can move to out in the rotation areas in the Great Wicomico if they decide to do the project, and it all depends on what how their bids come in as to whether that'll happen or not. We'll do the same, allow private to take seed in the Great Wicomico and the Yang Tank again, as we have been doing. There's not as much. We've not had as much spat set as we've had in other years, but we have about 20,000 bushels available in the Yang Tank and about 10,000 bushels in the Great Wicomico, of which if a private person wants to do it, they have to pay back either that cost or 2 bushels of shell for every bushel of seed that they take out. And it's kind of a lottery as to who gets to participate. This just shows a little bit about what we see on the standing stocks, and the important thing to see here is that when you compare the Corps sanctuary areas in the Great Wicomico with our areas, they're almost identical, even though we are taking a harvest out of ours. This is ours. You know, we had a big set in 2012 in the Great Wicomico, just like other areas, but it was bigger in our area because in the process of us taking shells out, we're putting taking the seed out, we put 2 bushels of shell back. So there's always fresh shells on ours. So we've actually been doing a little bit better than the ones set aside as sanctuaries. And then again, in the Piang Tank, even though we've been taking for the past number of years from the harvest areas and replacing shell, it's very similar to the stock assessment numbers for the areas that we don't touch. So we don't think this little bit of harvest that we allow causes any problems. For in your packet, you'll see there's a big chart on all the areas in the state that need shell right now. Shell disappears naturally on bars in Virginia. They dissolve, they get boring sponge, they break down, and the harvesting process distributes them and takes them away. And we actually were kind of in the best condition that we've ever been for shell in that 2008-2012 period when we had done some shell planting. But we find ourselves now when we monitor for the number of oysters on bars, we also monitor for the quantity of shells on the bars. And in that table, you can see that we have more than 1,400 acres now of harvest areas that we actively work that have very low levels of shell, getting down to the point that the likelihood of spat set is pretty low, should you have a spat set. So if you have larvae in the water, there's not many shells to attach. And with $2 million, since the price of shells has gotten so much, we'll only be able to do maybe 400 or 500 acres of those. So we are going to be running a negative shell budget, both naturally as well as the fact that we don't have money to shell all these areas. But the areas that we don't shell will be compromised for future spat sets. And we get out as many shells as we possibly can, and that's as far as the money goes. Just to show you kind of a schematic of the different areas, and especially as it relates to the next year, these are the areas that will be open. If they're red, and that's the upper Rappahannock, if any have been there, that area is pretty much gone. Haven't got any sets. The shells are in real bad shape. But the yellow areas that you can see here that they will be open next year are also, in need of shell, and we see declining stocks in them. The only two areas that we actually see that kind of holding their own are the James River and the Great Wicomico, where spat sets are pretty dependable, but we have invested money in shells in recent years. The areas that probably need the shell the most this year are Tangier, Pocomoke, and the Rappahannock. And that's with the money we get this year, we'll probably be concentrating mostly in those. There's a couple areas in the James that we may do according to what the prices come in, but this just shows kind of all the areas in Pocomoke that need shell. These areas in Tangier need shell. And these areas, the pink ones in Rappahannock, need shell. And there's more than this. Obviously, this is just the ones that we might be able to afford for this year.
Jim, how about the York?
We've done in need shell, but we've shelled in there the past couple of years, so we need to go to these other ones and try to catch up on some.
And Mobject?
Mobject, we did like 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay, 2 or 3 years. Okay.
So these are here the ones, some of the ones that need, these ones need shell in the James. Now, and that's the biggest part of the program, obviously, is just doing shell. And we will mostly be using dredge shell that we dredge in the James River. We know we're running out of shell, and last year we did a project with the Nature Conservancy to try some ground concrete to see how that would work as a shell substitute, thinking way down long term in the future what we'll use when shells are gone. And we actually use shell side pieces that we could actually spray off the boat just like shell, and they did really well. I mean, this is a piank tank. They're covered with spat. Actually, the concrete had the highest spat that we saw in the piank tank this past year. But we also did, but this area that we did in the piank tank is a sanctuary area, so we don't really care too much about whether it's harvestable. We tried the same concrete in the Rappahannock in a harvest area, and we actually got an okay spat set on it. But the problem is that we were using pieces that were like 3 or 4 inches, and when you use your dredge or your patentong on those areas, when you it looks like to us when we handle the concrete with the orchards on them that it's going to kill the orchards on them just in the harvesting process of banging them once against each other. So we're going to do another harvest area this year in the Rappahannock down in Area 1 with smaller size pieces of we're actually going to use granite this year because we had some issues this past year with the cleanliness of the concrete. So we're just going to buy granite that's mostly about 2 inches and try that and see if that works as a substitute for shell. And hopefully that will be small enough that it will go through the bags, which the catch will actually be the orchards with that are on the pieces that have it, and they won't be heavy enough to do damage. So it's another experiment to see if we can find another material to use.
Jim?
Yeah?
Have you called Dan?
I emailed him, yeah. Dan, are you on here? I emailed him at lunchtime and sent all the stuff to him.
Yeah, I'm on here.
Okay, all right, good. The only other part of the replenishment plan that we're doing is we have some money with the Nature Conservancy that is pretty much they got money from Hurricane Sandy damage that they're going to do some reefs up around Chincoteague, around Assateague Island, and then down in Worcester, and we're going to help them just do the shell part of it for that, and it just basically is a pass-through where they give us a contract and we get our shell guys, just give some work to our shell person that's over on the Eastern Shore to keep him busy and keep his equipment up. So that's actually the replenishment part.
I'd like to ask a question.
Any questions on that?
Is there a big difference between the cost of shell versus concrete and granite? And the other question is, would the granite or rocks have to be knocked off a shelf when they're harvested, like shells do?
Yeah. Okay. You still have to call off and say right. You would. And
so a rock being on that's knocked off, okay.
And we don't know what, you know, we're doing very small projects right now with the ground concrete.
Okay.
We will get, or the granite. If you get into more economies of scale, I think the prices will go down. But for the general individual planner, they're probably about the same.
Okay, thanks.
As shell. Maybe a little bit less. Mm-hmm. Depends on if the price of shell continues to go up.
Mm-hmm.
The rock is pretty much set by all sorts of different trades, building and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Jim, how many bushels were you planning on putting on Area 1 in Rappahannock? Got an estimate?
Well, everywhere gets 1,000 bushels per acre, and you can start.
Okay.
It just what comes up in our stocks. Mm-hmm.
All right.
So. Yep.
How come we're following the economies of scale with the granite, concrete, and reef shells, but setting the price of house shells at $2 and not following the economy of scale with that? Being as that's been proven to be the most positive asset to put overboard.
Well, the price of shells, the situation right now for oysters is pretty dire. We're in a very we've dropped all the pig. We've had 3 years out of the past 4 with no spat sets. And you know, if I was going to appeal to anybody, I would appeal to them to lower the prices of the shell.
But you're one entity that's trying to drive a whole economy. And everybody, I said, you're one entity trying to drive a whole economy that everybody else is willing to, from private individuals to the Army to other states, willing to pay a higher price. How come you're not following, just the same as if they decide a major highway project and Granite goes up? You're willing to follow that economy and pay the price.
With the lowest price.
I'm just saying, how come you're setting the price at $2 for shells?
We're allowed to set the price on shells.
I understand that.
The other ones we have to put out for bid.
But you don't have to get the shells.
We don't have to get them.
That's my point, is why don't you follow the price to get the shells, which is the best substrate to put overboard?
Well, we've set the price for this year at $2.
Understand, that's not my question.
Nobody's going to sell it, but that's
That is my point, and you still have yet to answer the question of how come you don't follow.
Because I can get more for the state by using the dredge shells at this point.
What's the cost of the dredge shells?
It'll be about four.
$4 a bushel. So how are you getting more at $4 than you are at two?
That's overboard. The $3 that they asked for on the pile translates to about $4.50.
But Jim,
for an inferior, you're talking about shell degradation and everything that you read about half-life of shells and shells being put overboard and degrading due to what you just mentioned, shell bores, their environment. How can, doesn't the superiority of that house shell outweigh the 50 cents difference in putting the moral sand that is a dredge shell back overboard in its place?
We use non-moral science.
Because, I mean, again, the overall benefit is as much important as the price of what you're paying to get it.
But generally, the bores and things like that seem to be worse in house shells than they are in dredge shells.
Because they've already decomposed the dredge shells.
Well,
that's why they're ancient and sunk.
They seem to hold up. So.
Okay.
Is that what the data shows, Jim, and some of the stuff with using fossil shell and using house shell on some of these plants? There's no difference.
Very difference, but it looks like a fossil shell may last a little longer. And it's, we are, we're stuck at 2 million. I mean, when we actually, in 2007, when we had Blue Ribbon Orchard Panel, it was a recommendation of that panel and then that we should be doing $2.5 million a year, and that's when we were getting shells overboard for less than $1.50.
It was also the recommendation of that panel to use house shells.
Well, but the actual money that we received was $2 million, and when we started out with that money, the price was still reasonable, but the more years we keep the $2 million, the more that they want to raise the price on shells. So, it's like we're being with the money's going up. Where if we put out on the straight bid, we're out on bid.
How does the price of the concrete compare to the fossil shell and the regular shell?
It's about the same. Mm-hmm.
It seems like we're getting a butter spat set from that,
But if we can't handle it, we've got to figure out a side. Other states are trying in big ways, mm-hmm. granite and mm-hmm. concrete. And we're not the only one that's experiencing
it. Right.
Mm-hmm. How come everyone else is willing to pay the high price for the shells? Obviously they are. It wouldn't be driven to the point that it is.
You mean everybody like who?
The Army, other states, private individuals.
The Army doesn't really care for, a cost-benefit return. They're in it for 100% sanctuaries. So they don't care.
Yes, sir. And
came in for them is $10 a bushel. So.
I understand that. And if you want to get to a cost-benefit point, in a paper that you co-authored in 2009 about the research on the Rappahannock and the rotation, the only way that it could be positive for the state was for Colt's prices to be, let's find my notes here, Colt's prices to be at 70 cents a bushel or less. So you're $1.30 over it in what you're willing to pay for shells now.
Except for the, that was written before we had the bump in the harvest, so it's obviously very different now than it was.
That was based on the harvest back in 2008, which is very small compared to what we had previously.
Okay.
So, I mean,
but all those parameters were moved in your study.
Hmm?
I said all those parameters were moved around in your study. The harvest and effort, everything was moved, and those were the only two things that drove it to profitable for the state.
Well, I mean, the long and short of it is that it's profitable. What we're trying to do when to justify shell planting is that you get a return to the taxpayer that's more, as much as we possibly can, into the economy. I mean,
then maybe shell planting isn't the answer for the $2 million. Maybe some other means of restoration or means of improving water quality or some other angle of coming at this problem is the answer versus just throwing shells overboard.
That's
something that should be looked at.
We certainly look at that all the time, but nobody has come up with an alternative to bring orchard back different than shells at this point, or different than gulch, of one form or the other.
Jim, what's the forecast for fossil shells? How long do you expect that to last?
What we have up there, maybe 5 years, but there are other sites potentially.
Any update on that, on the other sites?
I think I'll get some out of Florida at one time.
$10 a bushel.
I think so.
I can get out of Mexico, too.
Oh, yeah. Nothing closer.
Way above what we can afford to. I mean, if we get to the point with $2 million, you're doing 100,000 mm-hmm. bushels. We'll never see any return. Shells is the currency of making these areas go, and they disappear over time. And we are, you know, if we miss just 1 year in SPATSEP, we won't hold our own. And the fact that in a year, you know, a 4 year spell we've gone through now, we've only had SPATSEP 1 year, we are not holding our own at all. We're actually very deep in a shell budget where we're falling behind. I mean, it's not like the Tiang Tank in the Great Wicomico. Or the James, Upper James, where you see spatsets all the time and you actually make shell back and you can hold yourself at neutral or actually in some areas in Upper James we have a few rocks that actually make shell, but they are the only ones in the whole state or the whole Chesapeake Valley. And it counts, you have to have dependable spatsets every single year to make your shell back because your shell is disappearing all the time. And that's in unharvested areas. When you add harvest to it, it's even more than that. Yeah.
Have you considered dredging some of these rocks? Like years ago we did it because they used to hire a bunch of the watermen. We'd take these large crab dredges on some of these old boats we had, and we'd go out and take the bags down, just leave the chain bag, take the bags out. We'd go into different rocks, and we'd drag them for 2 or 3 weeks straight and cut all these oysters, these shells back at the bottom and turn them over. And it worked quite well in the Rappahannock. But we did it all over the bay, and it had pretty good at that time.
A lot of those experiments since I've been here in 1992, and we've never seen any improvement in spatset in the area that you did turning and cleaning versus not turning and cleaning. And in fact, you know, if that was a reasonable thing, then we should be seeing, much better spatsets in these rotation systems. In the area the year after versus the one that was closed that year, you would see some bounce in the process, and we don't see any of that happening.
Well, we use much heavier dredges. We use them old big bays, crab dredges, 7-8 footers,
We use those. When I first got here, we did a number of those, and we never could see a difference in fat set.
More questions from Tommy.
Jim, if I do the math right on the Rappahannock, you're looking at about 42% of the shell going to sanctuary. Are they not holding their own with the recruitment they've got on?
And what actually gets done, a lot of the sanctuaries are so small that we're not going to be able to get to them with the bigger shovel. So, I mean, we pretty much got it. We'll have to take that group, and we'll have to take a subset of that group, and we can't afford even all that group, then we could actually get on to with the bigger barges.
Would you consider taking a couple of them and harvesting them and doing some sort of comparison? I mean, if they're not holding their own without shell, why wouldn't you work them and put them in rotation?
Well, because we have enough around them that if we do that, I won't be able to continue to make my point with the people that want all sanctuaries that they buy, and I won't have the... I mean, it's a very important part of the question amongst everybody about whether sanctuaries have an harvester is that if you leave them alone, that they will be self-maintaining. We have the best data around that doesn't happen. And if we start harvesting them, then we will quickly lose access to that data. So at this point, we maintain our sanctuaries when they need shell, just like we do with the harvest areas. It's all just straight. Whatever comes up at our threshold for shell per meter, that's where we put them into the rotation to get shell.
Other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
I remember being in this meeting last year, and we were talking about the price of shells, and we said we're going to be in a wait and see on the shell price because we think it's going to level out at this point and it's going to stop. Well, this year, last year, we didn't plant many house shells because of that. We were going to do the wait and see kind of thing. And we're talking about how far behind we are on spat sets. I feel like that's because the house shells aren't being planted. And then here we are this year, we're going to pay even less and going to get even less shells, and we're going to be even further behind the ball next year because I bet on that panel right there, I can't speak for foot. I bet the vote to pay 50 more cents for hoe shells over duck shells, that panel, it will be voted through to pay the extra 50 cents. I'm talking about you said $4.50 versus $4. I guarantee you that they'll say that it makes more sense to pay 50 more cents for hoe shells. And my point is, last year we were waiting to see if we're going to let the hoe shell price level out. It's not leveling out, and we're steady on behind and letting other states come and scoop our shells up and go. And they're Maryland and everybody else steady coming ahead on their way. I don't understand. You say that the drug shells, the concrete, everything else, kind of like what Mr. Johnson said, those people tell you what you're going to pay. The other thing, you're telling everybody else what you're going to pay. I don't understand that. When we pull up on scales to buy concrete or rocks, the price, that man tells us what we're going to pay for that. Why can't we tell what you're going to pay us for our show?
Because
the price on shows this year is $3. That's what the price has been set at. And you're going to sit here at $2 and let them all go wherever they may go, except for back where they came from. And that's in the Rappahannock, York River, James River. That's where they all the house shells came from.
Well, it's not as simple as that, because if you siphon off a bigger amount of shells and seeing the prices, it was up almost 50% last year on the year before, and then this year it's up another 50%. But if you decide to go the route to go the house shells, then you lower the amount that you have available for a contract for the dredge shells, and you pay more for the dredge shells.
But if you got more house shells, you don't need dredge shells.
Yeah, I mean, but what it means is the total thing that you're doing is you're getting a 450 shell for everything, so you get less on the bottom. I mean, the goal is to try to get as many shells. I mean,
the goal is to put a good.
I don't agree with it being the goal to get the most shells in the water. I don't agree with that. I agree that the effort that we should put through is put what's in the water that's going to be the most effective. Whether it's less bushel, that makes more sense to me if it's more effective than putting the other depth. And I believe it's more effective for those shells.
Could I ask a question? Have you done any studies to see if dredge shell
versus house shells, which is more effective in getting strike?
Not directly, but we see not differences. We don't see differences out there. We don't have them side by side on the same site. They're close to each other, but we don't see differences between one in, side by side, nothing. But have we put a box?
What about Roger? Would Roger, is there a difference that you know of, Roger?
We did a quick talk of this afternoon when we were at the coach. With both of them, I can find you examples all of the way from four to very high. You look at the ranges that overlap. So to say that one is unequivocally better than the other, it's location dependent. And we don't have any spots where we find it from side by side to give you the exact characteristics you want.
So far as you know, they're the same.
We don't know because we haven't put them in the same place.
We don't know because we haven't put them in the same place in a large enough place. And where we look back historically to do this, when we have anything like that, we always do it in years where it turns out we have an out of spat set. Like the camera grade that we did last year, where none of the camera grade turned up. Really, what you need to do is to do it for a few years on the run. That's not going to answer your question if we have at the moment.
It doesn't. So it certainly, you know, so we're somewhat subsidizing him in hopes that we may need him in the future.
Well, he's sort of got you over a barrel here because he's got the only dredge that's big enough.
Then that makes you wonder, is it worth it, or is it worth spending the money on the house shells, which you've got available? I mean, yes, you have to manage it long term, but at the same time, letting one operation dictate what goes on in the entire state of Virginia is kind of a farce, in my opinion.
Only been one shell dredger for forever.
It's still a farce to let him dictate it. If he wants, if he chooses to go out of business, then he chooses to go out of business. It's not the state of Virginia's job or charge to keep him operational because they may one day need him.
Any other questions or comments of Jim on the replenishment plan? Yes, sir.
Good idea.
Thank you. We have any other comments or questions from the committee on the plan? I think what Jim's looking for is, or what we should come out with, is a recommendation that goes to the commission.
So we're looking for a motion there?
Well, or I guess the shell planting is what we've talked about most, but are people in agreement with the rest of the plan outside of the shells?
You don't have a lot of options on this, do we? I mean, other than the concrete or the shells at this point.
Well, I mean, this committee could come up with, you know, a recommendation that would say it would be more per bushel, and the recommendation would be to use all of the available house shells versus the dredge shells, if that was, you know, the intent of the committee, and take that to the commission, and then it could be discussed there. Whatever that balance would be, I guess, between house shells that would be available at a certain price and the fossil shells.
John? Jim, what's... I mean, do you have commitment from the processors that you can get all this house shell? And how much house shell is available?
Not enough for $2 million.
What would you project?
Maybe 300,000 bushels.
So you're saying we can take the money that's allotted for shell planting and buy all the house shells in the state of Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying we can take the $2 million that's allotted for shells, and buy, if we're willing to pay the price, and buy every house shell in the state of Virginia to put overboard?
Yeah, dredge shell then. Because he won't come down for that much money.
What does he require?
Certainly needs a pretty good chunk of what we have now.
So what would that be in dollar figures?
It's much better if you can go all one or all the other.
So our management money is managing Langenfelder. So our management money is managing Langenfelder instead of managing strictly the resource.
No, it's trying to put the most shells that we can put on the bottom.
Well, I mean, you're saying 300,000 bushels you can get from people that would give it to you now is your projection. That would leave 1.6.
No,
$4 million for
$3. It would be, I mean, $3 a shell plus the planting, you'd be up around
1.2 million. Yeah. So you'd have $800,000 left.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To subsidize Langenfelder.
No, he wouldn't come for that.
Tommy.
So, if the harvest next year or the year after is significantly lower than what it has been, and the situation in the Gulf hasn't improved, and we're not getting house shells because there's no production, or, you know, a reduced amount, where are shells going to come from if we don't have Langenfelder? I mean, so that, to me, that's one of the reasons to try and keep Langenfelder coming, is we don't know what's in the future. I mean, it could have some very lean times as far as where we're going to get shells.
And in that same future, you said you've only got 5 years of Langenfelder coming to begin with.
Well, on the sites that we have permitted.
How many shells, if you're saying with the money we've got right now, you could buy 300,000 bushels of house shells and have $800,000 left?
Mm-hmm.
What's the total number of bushels that your plan puts overboard? Concrete, shells?
Well, I mean, using the 2 million, it'll be somewhere around 500,000.
We are, no, we are letting Langenfelder dictate this process because we're scared to death we might lose him.
Do you anticipate the need for dredge shells or fossil shells to increase the next few years with probably the diminished stock of oysters in the bay and the availability?
We need to plant every possible shell we can. And, I mean, as many as we can maintain the minimal amount of shell that we see we need in order to get spat set.
Right. But what I'm getting at, it looks like with the production is going to go down the next few years because of the bad spat set. Do you think we need to, we're going to need to rely on fossil shell more than house shell?
Well, you know, the history of shell is that when oysters were doing well in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they did not sell, houses did not shell. It sells to say we did 100% dredge shell, pretty much. And then as disease became a factor and people stopped planting, stopped using stuff on their own ground, then there was a real interest to, for the houses to sell to us, and we stopped using Langenfelder, but he was still, that shell dredging process was still working in Maryland because they didn't have the shucking houses that we had. So now as, you know, we've flipped now and we've gone to where people are planning. We have a lot of people that want shell, so it's bidding up the price of shells at the houses. And so in the past few years, we've used majority dredge shells again. We went back to what we used to do. So it's all pretty much just, you know, where is the bidding coming for the shell? I mean, the dredge shell is just a straight company, marine contractor, bidder situation where you do our best proposals and they supposedly give you the best price that they can. And we negotiate the price with them down as much as we can. Where the house shell is, you know, it's pretty much what high bidder is willing to pay for right now.
So really, we have two sources of shell, so we really can't afford to put all our eggs in one basket.
Except for there, the only problem we get into is that it used to be, you know, two straits doing shell or contracts, but if there's a certain amount, they'll just use the shell dredge for digging mud somewhere rather than mess with doing shell. There's a minimal amount for mobilization and demobilization to come down and do the project. And if it gets below like $1 million, they would not come for. I mean, that's, you know, I wish we had more money. I wish but we don't.
So surf clamp shells, is that something that...
They've disappeared, you know, that they're pretty much gobbled up in the Northeast before. And, you know, we used to have a place where you could get them, several places where you get them in the state, and they've all now moved to the Northeast. So
okay, they're not in here.
Not available.
So to reiterate what you just said is that it takes the majority of our money, the state of Virginia's money, to keep Langenfelder, an out-of-state contractor, in our pocket to hopefully down the road benefit us.
Take
and
the majority of our money to get the lowest price.
And
say.
No, you just said it took over $1.5 million to get him down here for him to come dig him.
Over
a million, so it takes over half of our budget just to get him to come
but the more
work
gets,
for us.
The lower the price it is.
Okay, my question, just wanted to make sure I understood what you said. My question is, and maybe Dr. Mann can help with the answer as well, the net benefit of, does the net benefit of the 300,000 bushels of house shells and $800 in our pocket to do concrete, toilet seats, whatever you want to do, outweigh the net benefit of getting 500,000 bushels of a mixed match bag of house shells, maybe dredge shells, concrete, and toilet seats? Because that's the net, that is the goal of the money, is to maximize the net outcome.
Almost no shell planting at all. It's all planted and by huge
keep planting it in the same place, it aggregates, it becomes a little bit like pavement. And so part of the problem with rubbing that stuff is over the long term, you actually don't know if you're going to get it to the point where you can't even put a dredge in it. So it's a very touchy thing to start using in large amounts. The problem that we have here with it is we don't have Kentucky upstream in time for projects to bring it to. If you want to spend a million plus on house shell, let's all make the assumption that house shell is the best stuff that you can get. Okay? I don't think anybody in the room will disagree. The only debate really is dredge shell much worse, the same, or somewhere in between. But if you start with lots of good house shell and you say, okay, Langenfelder for $800,000 says I'm better off dredging something else. You've got $800,000 left. What are you going to do with it? Where are you going to find enough granite or enough concrete that you can use? Planting granite here is not the same as planting it in the Mississippi mud. But everybody in this room has got more experience planting stuff than I have, but I watched this stuff being planted in the Mississippi mud, and I can't think of anywhere in the bay that it would be the same. So if we decided to go that way, we wanted to take some of these rocks and plant it with granite. We have no idea that we're going to do it right. We might screw it up royally. I want to respond to the experiment. We're not at the point where we can do really large scale $800,000 experiments and screw it up. That's the first one. Concrete looks really good. But then the question becomes, and again, you guys arbitrate this stuff, I don't. If we don't get the size right, lots of ice is all crunched up. And if we get all the oysters in, and we don't crunch them up, we don't try and sell them to Mr. Kellum at the dock, and he's going to say, well, it was a bushel of oysters. Now I got 3/4 of a bushel of oysters, and I've got 1/4 of a bushel of concrete. I don't know how that all works when you look at what the outcome is. Certainly, these are things that the gentlemen can have to think about. I think they're good things that you should think about. I think the challenge that you have is that there's a learning curve on all of them. We're all at the bottom of the learning curve. So if we've got $800,000 that you want to spend on learning next year, you can do that. But we might well screw it up. And that's sort of the problem that we have at the moment. I sympathize with your point that we should keep all our house shells here and the good stuff. I absolutely agree with you. If we're not going to get the other stuff, we've got $800,000, we're going to sit here and we're going to design something that might work. Some of it might work. It might be a big mess. Or even if we get all the stuff out and we turn up at Mr. Kellum's dock, it might not be something that we can use. Somewhere in the midst of this over the next few years, we're going to have to sort that out.
And
so with all due respect, I don't want to spend $800,000 trying to sort it out next year and find out that we've got everything wrong.
Most of this restoration has been trial by fire anyway, has it not?
Well, some of it has.
Some of it has been educated science. Some of it has been trial by fire.
I mean, a lot of the things that we did 10-plus years ago, quite frankly, were not that well done. Some of the things that we've done in the last 10 years, and there's a lot of people in this room who've contributed to this. We've gone to rotational harvest. We've worked out how much stuff we can take off, how much stuff we can put back. We can look at things in a productive manner, when we need to go and add a little bit more, whether we need to think about adding stuff on scale. I mean, there's been a lot of very productive discussions in this room over the last few years, and I think we've learned a lot more. So what we're doing now in terms of a projected program, I think, is a lot more stable than where we were 10 years ago. That still doesn't mean that we should waste $800,000 if we can't find the best way to spend it.
Tom.
What about a consideration of taking enough money to buy 150,000 bushels of house shells, and then that still leaves Langenfelder $1.4 million? Is the total $2 million set aside for shell planting? So that would still give him $1.4 million to mobilize and set up. And another point, just to get it on the table, when you talk a scenario that Mr. Leggett talked earlier about a collapse in North Hill, I think it's awful presumptuous to think the General Assembly is going to continue to dole out $2 million when they don't see the benefits of all these people working and the people working for me and throughout the system. So I think you got to keep that in mind too, that, you know, it might be a moot point as far as house shells or Langham felt to either one if we don't have the money to purchase it. So, and I think that's pretty likely if given the amount of publicity that our industry has gotten the last 18, 24 months, when they start hearing from folks that it's imploded, we got to keep that in mind too. So I don't think buying around just the $2 million is a great idea either. We need to keep that in the back of our mind.
Yeah, my question is, so we are going to experiment with some concrete,
yeah.
And why can't we, instead of putting shells on some areas on these sanctuaries, why can't we experiment with that concrete?
That's what we did with it last year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
On James River.
We're trying not to use any shell on sanctuaries if we possibly can.
James River's a little more unique than the other rivers. We do have a lot of seed of this river. I mean, a lot of seed on the upper part of the James, up before the ships. Why not go ahead and plant the seed on your areas that you plan to plant? And what's seed running at? $4 a bushel? That's cheaper than you can go buy the stuff and put it overboard. And if the seed dies, you still got the shells there. And plus, you can create work. You can let the watermen plant the stuff for you after the season at a set time, and you'd have to lump it, you know, and figure out how many bushels each boat's putting over. That'd probably be a cheaper way, at least for the James anyway. These other rivers are going to have a little more of a problem. That might save some of your problems. It might be cheaper than any other way to do the James.
Well, we have a quota in the James that we would shoot that if we're not careful. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of the river, the marsh has been there so long that it snapped out. It really needs to be cleaned off and allow some fresh oysters to start striking back. You know, once they get so snap and spindle, they're not much good to nobody in one sense, but they'll still work for clutch and striking purposes. And most likely, a lot of the stuff you bring down the river might die anyway because of the change in the water. Or you probably have some survival rate, but it'll still do the job that you're looking for.
Well, that's a fragile shell compared to a alkaline shell or a house shell.
That should be a consideration.
Much density down with them as you're in.
Any other questions, comments? What's the pleasure of the committee? They want to come out with a recommendation for the commission or to kind of leave it as is?
Excuse me for not saying this, but just exactly what it is that you prefer that be done. Just exactly what is it that you prefer that would be done here? $2 million bushels, $2 million spent strictly?
The plan is not for you, but the preferred plan. So, $2 million for a shell.
Okay, and that's broke down in what way?
Anybody that wants to sell to us for the price that we've set from the houses or and the rest go to the dredge shell.
So specifically you're thinking that you have said that you project you would get how much house shell?
I don't know if I get any sent in to me at $2 a bushel.
So you really don't know, you might not get any.
Well, I'd like to make the motion that we suggest to the commission that they discuss the possibility and opportunity to pay fair market price for house shells. And
up to what amount?
Up to the fair market value. Not necessarily per bushel.
Can that be done, Jim? I thought that was in code. Or am I missed? Or well, I missed something?
We would set the price.
The right to set the prices in code.
You'd have to just pull around and see what everybody's willing to set the sell at, which is pretty much they told me $3.
Because by setting it at $2, it's an asset sitting there that we're saying we don't want to buy. Because we're a dollar, dollar and a half, even sometimes $2 underneath fair market value. So we're literally saying thank you, but we don't want it.
So if you did say $3 and you set a quantity that you would buy $3, that would be something left for the guys to dredge them?
Yes, sir.
So what would be the breakdown?
What is the minimum that Langdonfelder would come since?
Probably 1.5.
So it's maybe 500,000 worth at $3 and then 1.5 at dredge. Is that acceptable?
I would say 150,000. Yeah, I would say 150,000 at fair market value, and let Langenfelder squeeze a little.
Does that sound workable, Jim? You think?
I mean, it's a suggestion. I think $3 and then plus the transportation and everything, it'll end up being more than the $500,000.
Go ahead and make that motion.
The motion that the commission discuss and review paying fair market price for 150,000 bushels of house shells and negotiating with Langenfelder over the difference.
I'll second.
Any more discussion on the motion? Tommy.
Could we have that? Could we segregate the shell from the rest of the replenishment?
I think that's what we're doing. Yeah.
I feel like I need to abstain from the shell portion of it. I'm in favor of it, but I think given our company's involvement, I need to abstain from
voting.
Is that possible to have the committee come out with a separate recommendation for?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you can accept everything else except for that. Or if you want to do it in two motions, that'd be fine.
So the motion on the table is pay fair market price, $3 or more per bushel for 150,000 bushel of house shells, and the rest, the balance of that would be made up to a marine contractor. And that would be a separate motion from the rest of the plan. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Noes?
Abstain.
Okay. Motion passes. We have the rest of the replenishment plan on the table. Any other questions or comments for Jim from committee members about the plan or a motion?
Yeah. So moved.
Yeah, I'm going to accept the rest of it. I'll second by Tommy.
Okay. Motion by Tommy and second by Tommy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Jim?
Yeah. But the last bit that's in your plan is there was a request this winter from a committee or a group that's working on orchard restoration in the Lafayette River, this is a picture of it. It's one of the tributaries of the Elizabeth River. And if whether or not you're familiar with the Elizabeth River, it's different than all the rest of our rivers in that it's condemned, but it's condemned prohibited. It means that you can't relay, you can't do anything down there because there are chemicals that could be in the orchards that the relaying process they remove. And over the past couple of years or several years, there's been a lot of effort put into orchard restoration in the Lafayette through these other groups, NOAA, CBF, the Corps, City of Norfolk, and we also did some work in the Lafayette years ago. So in total, they've done about $1.5 million worth of work there, and we have done another $300,000 worth in years past. There's been an effort by the Elizabeth River Project to get the prohibited status removed from that Lafayette. And if that would happen, it would change the normal type restricted condemnation where you could relay. And what the group asked for was, could we set a line and so that if this change does occur, that there wouldn't be any leasing up there around all these restoration sites that they've done. And that's showing you that that's a line from Tanner Point over to just above where ODU comes down there, but it's entering into below Hampton River Bridge. In the discussions with this, knowing the situation, several situations that are going on, where we know that we have had a significant decline in our spat sets in the past number of years. And what we have seen last year and the end of the year before was a big run on private grounds, trying to lease things everywhere, a big land rush to do the leases, and about 20% of these leases have been applied for in condemned areas. When we saw this happening in the middle of the summer, you know, I had hoped to maybe talk about it then, that the fact that these areas may be more important for broodstock sanctuaries than for leasing, because the idea in leasing ground is that you propagate and that you plant shell seed or you put cages in an area, and with shells, seed, and the expense of cages being so high, it did not seem like there was any business model where you would go to a condemned area and put shell seed or anything in that area and then look to get it out, because of that additional price of the relaying is makes it not competitive, and if you got good ground other places, you're not going to waste your shell in condemned areas. So it seemed a good idea at that point to potentially talk about setting these areas, unleased areas, aside as sanctuaries to provide broodstock for areas outside. And want to at least present to the commission tomorrow the idea that, yes, this, you know, it's reasonable for them to request this area in Lafayette in this situation. There's nothing going on there. But also to go further and to consider setting all areas that have not been leased now as sanctuaries and not taking any more applications for them.
In the condemned areas.
In the condemned areas, yeah.
Not impacting current leases in condemned areas.
And just showing you examples of, you know, this, that is the way the total Elizabeth lays out with the, and the double hatch is the area that you can't do anything, and there'll never be any changes up these areas, but this one branch over here, they're looking to change that so that it would be similar to the one out here where you could relay. But you see these applications all in these condemned areas, this one here up in Mill Creek, up the Hampton River, some up the James, up the Warwick. These areas that are applications just in straight condemned areas that you're not going to ever invest in seed or shell in those areas. This is the same map, just putting the private ground in there, and there's some private ground up in them now that have gotten away from us, but most of them are still in the application stage. And it's not just that. Here's one of the Piang Tank, same way up Queens Creek in the Piang Tank where somebody's applied for area that's condemned, and very likely most of the interest in these areas is to go catch the oysters that's there, take what's there, and be done with it. You're not. There's no plans on going back to do any shell or seed. If they do, there'll be relaying, and when you do that, that ties up law enforcement from monitoring a relaying project in an area where they could be out monitoring the clean areas, and it would be a better use of their time. So it seems like something to consider now to actually set these areas that are in condemned areas aside, especially in this period we're going through when we're getting no spat sets, and see if we can get things start going the other way.
Any other questions from the committee? 1 minute, sir. Anybody? No? Yes, sir.
That's Glenn's Island right there. Okay.
Yep.
And the Island Motel is right there. 223 Road.
That's right, right there.
Right there.
Yep.
Is that contaminated right there?
Condemned in here, yes.
Why? Mm-hmm.
Because of Marina.
What does the Marina do to it?
Marina automatically forces the contamination.
Catching 8 to 10 bushels in the afternoon after school, and those old men were Harvey Huggins had a FIFO. He accused me and Paul Brown when he passed away now of stealing oysters off the man's oyster bed. Must have thought we don't steal oysters. We oysters right there for a whole winter. And we made as much money as those old men did.
Hopefully it wasn't condemned that
time. It's not condemned now.
It is condemned.
More current, more water flow through that mouth right there. 20 foot of water. It's not condemned.
Yes, ma'am.
This affected your statement that the entire area is condemned. It was my understanding that the Elizabeth River project had been successful in achieving a C rating in portions of the river, but that they are making progress towards eliminating the condemned areas. Am I incorrect on that?
Well,
you're going to blanket the whole
yeah,
area.
Yeah, they raised it themselves.
Say, pardon?
They raised it themselves.
Well, is there another rating body that says they
well,
have not been
the chemicals like the old creosote and the PCBs and everything are not going to work better.
Well, that's in part of the river, but part of the river has achieved a C rating, which is no longer a contaminated area. So for you to get up and say that the whole area is contaminated is inaccurate, as I understand.
They're considering Lafayette and that area that I said is looking to be checked. Lafayette is part of the river.
Right.
So that's the area that's gotten the better rating.
Right. So that portion should not be included in a free fall. No.
It will still be condemned. It will be condemned, but you'll be allowed to relay. Now you're not allowed to relay.
But your proposal is to take is to prohibit
leasing.
Any kind of leasing because of the condemned status, when in fact they're making progress in terms of the restoration.
Well, if it's changed, then that would change.
Well, not difficult to change the law once it's in place. You're proposing a change to the law that no new leases can be granted. Am I correct?
In a condemned area.
But you didn't limit it to condemned areas.
Yeah, that's
okay. Okay, but are portions of it not condemned any longer?
No.
Are portions of it being rehabilitated to achieve the C rating?
C rating will not change. It only changed the degree of contamination from you can't touch the water to you can't relay.
Okay. But we are making progress.
Yeah. It means it's a different combination that's going to be working there, not from chemical.
Tommy?
If the condemnation were completely eliminated, then it would be leasable.
Yeah, but that's my problem. There, in that one.
But if, like with this, in this area, I don't know if it's any private lease in that or any leasable bottom in that area, but if it were and the condemnation was lifted, then it would be open for leasing.
Are you talking about?
I'm not talking about any of it. I was just asking the question.
This green color right here is a lease application in a condemned area. Condemned there goes across the mouth of that creek right there. That's just one example.
Any other questions, Tommy?
Move for approval.
Do we need a motion on this or just?
It would be nice if you approve the, moving forward and considering this. That's going to flush out a regulation. So.
Okay, we got a motion for approval and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No? One no. Okay. Motion passes. Two no's.
Who made the motion and who seconded?
Tommy did.
Tommy.
And there were two no's.
Two no's?
Okay. Thank you. up to you. Yep.
Okay. All right. The rest of the discussion here is I want to kind of give you a background on what we're seeing with our stocks last month and what we're seeing in the numbers of people harvesting and what, you know, we have talked about effort control in here before, but it's kind of passes by and we're in much more need of it coming up than we have been in the past. Obviously, you know, this is the picture of the harvest. The blue there is the public. Our harvest has gone up significantly over the past 10 years or so. But along with that, you know, has been the increase in use in these two gears. That's the hand scrape and the dredge. If you look at the yellow there, that's the hand scrape that's increased with the harvest, and the green is the dredge. And really, this is that went through 2014, the beginning of the season this past fall, where we switched to requiring, even though it had been in a regulation, we started enforcing the fact of that you had everybody on the boat had to have a hand scrape license. This one where we left it here was only the one per boat. So we were up in the over 450 boats with hand scrape licenses. Looking at the 13-14 harvest, 220,000 bushel harvest, and with 85% of it coming from the it's not in y'all's handout. This is, don't be looking at that. This is just a presentation for you at this point. 85% of the harvest came from those two gear types.
Go back. How many?
Yep. And that was 13-14.
Thank you.
Again, the hand scrape's kind of being the one that's been the most used and the most areas, you know, kind of tracking along with the harvest. This past October, we had 651 hand scrape licenses, and that's really the only good month we have in with harvest so far. And it's, you know, it's probably not complete, but it's 33,000 bushels came in the first month in October. That's really all that we have to show for 14 so far. This is the table of the way the seasons were this past year and what was open. And just if we follow along like we have been doing for a number of years, it's the same kind of following the same thing of moving the rotation areas. This slide shows what'll be open next year. You know, in the Rappahannock, Area 5 and 3 will be open for hand scrape. There will be no reason to open the 7 and 8 because there's just nothing up there right now. It needs a while to recuperate. And then Tangier will switch over to Area 1. And I just show these so I can show you that what we see on standing stocks. I showed this before, but the yellow areas are the ones that are going to be opening next year, and we're seeing the stocks have declined a lot. Looking at these ones in the Rappahannock for next year, of course, Area 1 was open this year, but next year Area 3 and Area 5 will open. And this is the stock assessment just showing you biomass and the number of orchards. And it's not important to know that, just to look here, that all of these axes are the same on all these I'm going to show you. And so where we went into the Rappahannock this year, this is where we were up somewhere like that, and by the time we got out and did the survey, it was in the middle of November, so it was only like a half a month left of the season there. So it had dropped it down to here, the biomass of orchards. And so if you remember this location right here, this is the area that's going to open up next year. It has less in it than what we have ended up with in the when you look at Area 3, I mean,
is almost nothing.
But Jim, Area 1 was 95 acres. That's 11 acres.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, this is biomass. So it does vary with the how many we check. But the fact is, if you look at the, that's pretty much there's less to harvest in Area 3 than there was in 1. There's less in Temple Bay. But the reality is that's biomass that's there, and it's more acres.
How many acres were in 5?
46.
5 was, these are the ones that we take care of. These are ones that so that we monitor every year as kind of examples of what the whole area will be. I mean, it's not, I assume that everywhere that we don't monitor is in the similar place. It's not something popping up there that is different than what we look at. So, in all those cases, we pretty much is much less to harvest there. And if you just look at the spat set, in Temple Bay, this area, we had a little bit of a spat set in 2010, but we missed it altogether in the big one of 2012. And we just had low levels where, in Broad Creek, in that one, we got real good sets in 10 and 12. And we've even got more in 13 and 14 in years we did that much past that than we got in the area that's going to be open the next year. For the Tangier one, this year, Area 2 is a combination of this and Bokomok. This in Tangier was open this year. And this is where we were, fairly high levels of moistures. And this is what we see for the area that's going to be open next year. It's less acreage to harvest and less oysters. Mm-hmm. Even though we did see a little bit of spat set in Area 1 this year, but it's not going to help us for next year.
About Area 9 and 10?
There isn't an Area 10. Area 9, just get Area 9. Oh, those in Pomo?
Yeah.
There's nothing up there. There's no spats out there. We cleaned those all out last year.
Up there,
yeah, we
left
having our limit 10 o'clock every morning. Well, not at the end, you didn't. Well, this last day,
private ground,
and
all the
oysters
you want right
there. Has anybody checked it up there? Yep, we did.
When was that?
This fall. I mean, I can give those numbers to you. I didn't bring them here.
Huh? How accurate do you think these samples are? And just sort
they've been really good detectives of how good it's been.
Because from what I can see, you're saying that area 5, you're showing that the level of voice is going to be real low next year, right?
It'll probably be about where you started in the where you left in the Area 1.
When we left Area 1 off in Broad Creek.
At the end of the season, there's
okay. I was there.
Yeah.
When was the last time Area 5 was open?
3 years ago.
But you're still showing more oysters there now than we left there 3 years ago, according to your chart.
Well, no, because we usually get in the monitored area. That area opened first, you had harvested the dam by the time we got there. You have to kind of look at the area at the time. It has bounced back, but it's not bounced back like what you would like it to be. A lot of grass on each of the areas of the check. We've not been far off on it.
Do you use the same piece of equipment year after year?
Year after year.
This is the same point that was laying on the Doors machine shop last fall.
Mm-hmm.
So when he makes an adjustment to it, you don't make a change to it? I know what a winter grudge it does.
Yeah, this is a straight 1 meter.
You send your grudge off to have work done on it. You may have a whole different grudge.
1 meter is 1 meter. One square meter.
Yeah, but you're looking at the scientific part of it. But everybody in this room knows you can make two dredges and one will catch better than the other. You're using a piece of fabricated equipment.
I mean, our dredge survey shows the same thing.
Okay. I'm a little bit skeptical of the sample.
Hey, Jim, why don't we finish the presentation and then we can
talk
about questions.
All right. This is York. This area was open this year, Area 1. Again, everything's on the same thing. So if we had a lot of orchards when you went into Area 1, this is Area 2 that won't be open next year. But obviously we didn't get very much stat set there. So those numbers have gone down significantly. But this is the area that will be open in the rotation next year for the York area, and that'll be Mobshack, which is very little, and have not been getting very good spat sets. So we've got to try to figure out some ways to significantly reduce effort to be anticipating that, you know, we will have a half to less stocks than what we had this year, next year, and we had more people working this year than we should have had for the areas that had quite much stuff on them. So I'd like this group to kind of be thinking about what direction they want to do and coming up with strategies to reduce effort, because we don't want to chase down some ways that would not be the way that you wanted us to look, the ones you wanted us to look at the most. But just to run through these as just all as a group, based on what we see, if you kept everybody that you have out there right now, you'd have to go to this harvest per man and per vessel versus what we had this past year of 8 and 24. You know, and we had talked before, you could significantly shorten the day. It's kind of hard to enforce. We couldn't shorten the season lengths. The problem with shortening season lengths is that it makes an erratic amount of orchards coming into the market, so that so that there's something all days of the month, as opposed to having a 2-week season and then closed.
Well, if just Temple's Bay opens, I mean, it's not going to be but a week season anyway.
Yep, that's right, with the amount of people we have now. We could go to some quota system where, like Rockfish, you get a quota based on your mandatory reporting and assign everybody an amount that you get. You know, tag each basket and count them out. We could assign, let people choose a harvest area. So, say you can only work in one, which if you want to keep everybody in, then you choose the one you're going to go to, and you put limits on how many people could be in that area. Could eliminate the gear altogether, switch to hand tongs or patent tongs and not even have the dredges and the hand scrapes. And then the final one is to actually dig in and try to limit participation to something that, kind of halves the fleet from where we are right now. We set a July 1st control date. Since that control date, we've had 250 people come in since July 1st that are new. That kind of showed these numbers here. In 2014, we ended up with 651 hand scrape and 307 dredge licenses. In 13, we had 657 user fees, which entitled you to a lease. And then in 14, we were up to 872. And like I said, since we set the control date, it's been 251. We need to set some target that we want to get to if we use that, and come up with some criteria for if you're going to use the control date and you're going to limit on people, to all full-time people or people that have done mandatory reporting or time with an OSHA license or whatever you would come up with as a committee to determine who would be in and who would be out.
Are you saying 400 hand scrape and dredge combined?
Yeah.
And what are you at now? 307 and?
No, we were at 872 and
307.
Yeah.
So you're at over close to 1,200, and we need to get to 400.
Well, but that's user fees. So
Well, that was. Yeah. Yeah, 651 hand scrapes, 872 user fees. 651 and 307.
And then.
But some people have both.
Pocomo, the only area that has dredge.
Pocomo, Tangier. And a lot of people there have both. So there's a lot of overlap there. You just have to buy a dredge license, but you can still use your hand crank.
Well, you got to buy a dredge license. But he buys both of them.
Some of them buy both, yeah.
I buy both of them. We can't do it.
So I need y'all to give me some direction.
Are there any other rocks that can be opened up?
I built up York Grove up there around Bell Rock. That's all public rocks.
That's
all
private. That's private.
Huh?
Bell Rock's private.
Not according to the map. Got a Bell survey runs all the way up there to Bell Rock from Port of Patank.
Mm-hmm. There is a piece of public that runs from Port of Patank, but it doesn't go to Bell Rock.
Yeah, it does, too. According to the state map I've got, it shows it.
All the rocks up there are private.
Well, it's rocks inside of it between down and shore. Bell Rock is a public rock. Always has been.
Come on, all this marsh.
And it's a pretty good sized place up there, too. That's something that should be explored, open up, maybe. Kind of relieve some of the pressure off the other rocks.
Who leases that, Jim? Bell Rock.
Ronnie Howard.
Any questions from the committee about what Jim set out, either about reducing effort or these areas that anticipate low harvest?
So if you extrapolate that 400, what was 400 people, what would that make the total harvest be compared to what it is?
The harvest is going to be what it's going to be. I mean,
but I'm
400 people will catch everything there is to be caught there.
So how would that diminish the quantity that would be caught compared to this past year?
The past year?
That's going to cut it in half or cut it two-thirds?
Well, it'll be less than half in the rap in these ones that I showed you. I mean, there's still some orchards in the Great Wicomico, and the James is staying pretty stable in the hand scrape area.
So and this is going to be what we're talking about right here is applicable to the James as well, because I didn't see anything about the James here.
No, I didn't put that because I just showed you the ones that have dramatically gone down, which is
so you're not talking about changing anything for the James River. You're just
this
talking
one,
about for the rap.
The James River, because if you lower the total number of people, if you don't lower the total number of people, all of them will be in the James River.
So the bushels per person is applicable in one for everywhere if you do that.
Yeah.
But if you do something about the total amount of boats and not about the bushels per person, then people could still catch plenty more the oysters like they're catching in James, but there would be a diminishment in the other rivers simply because there's not much.
Four bushels per man is not going to make it because they can't survive off of that. You might as well shut the whole rivers down because they can't afford the expenses and everything else.
You got to give me an alternative to get the same place.
Yeah.
I think
any comments from the committee?
Well, could this be done in a way where you break it down where it would be different in the areas that require
a diminishment of harvest have one requirement versus area and that does not have
If you did that, product, everybody's going to migrate to the areas with the higher bushel limit.
Well, that would happen anyway because people are going to go where they can catch the oysters quicker anyway.
So I mean, but the fact is, if overall we have half the stocks next year we had this year, and we were catching a lot of these areas up by half a season this year, so.
So, in your opinion, if the amount of oysters that's caught this year is the same amount as caught next year, what would be left for the future?
Are you trying to guess what would be the?
I'm just trying to figure out how bad it is.
Over harvest next year, the total harvest. I mean, last year was like 220,000 off public.
Uh-huh.
This year it's hard, but pretty close to between and 220. Be very similar because we're working on the same path. Though. This next year will be half or less.
But what happened if, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Wayne.
If we delayed opening by 2 weeks and opened up all the areas that are going to be opened all at the same time?
Then all the oysters would be gone by Thanksgiving.
Well, after when November gets there, most everybody's going to James River anyway.
James will be open.
It opens in November. I say you got 2 weeks then. You have 2 weeks in October to work these areas. And by then, you know, over half the oysters are going to be caught off on all of them on some plot spots. If you open them up, you at least get the boats that are there to spread out. And when November comes, that poke them up. When is that open? December?
December.
Well, in November, you got boats that will migrate to dredge in the James. And then in December, you'll get them migrating back across the bay.
But there's nothing out there for them to catch.
But, if you open it up the first October, after a week, it's not going to be anything anywhere to catch. We'll just sit there and grind and grind and grind on the same spot.
That's why we need to get the number of boats down.
Ben,
when are you looking to make this decision? In August?
Well, we got between now and
August. That's right, but the ultimate decision is going to be made in August. Are we taking motions at this point, or are we taking suggestions?
I think this was just a discussion, Jim bringing it to people.
The reason I asked this is because that's 5 months away, and it's a very critical decision. And, excuse me, in the Code of Virginia, Section 28.2.550, in Section B, it says the commissioner, with the approval of the commission, may contract with any commercial fisherman to engage in replenishment, research, and stock assessments activities in the Commonwealth. Would it be unfair to ask that between now and the decision in August to put together a group of watermen that know the rivers, that know their equipment, and know what they're doing, to make a stock assessment to compare to the data that you have? Because I feel certain you could find a handful of volunteers.
I mean, that certainly can be a part of it, but
I mean, we're making a crucial decision here, and there's no need to make it without...
We're not making that decision this
afternoon. I know that. I'm saying in August we're making a crucial decision, and there's no need to make that without the most pertinent and the most amount of information that we can gather between now and then. There's no need to put those graphs back up on that screen in August and say this is what we've got when we've got 5 months and more than a room full of people who would be, I feel certain, would be willing to help. And just compare notes. Again, it's nothing but gathering information. When you make a decision, you can't have too much information.
The, it would have to be with a quantitative piece of equipment, not a dredge. They want to come with us.
Why is a dredge not a quantitative piece of equipment?
None of these areas will look bad on the first day.
You got to be able to replicate the same study in order to make it comparable. You can't take a study with using a dredge and then a patent on it. It's just not going to be. You're not going to get the same numbers. I mean, you got to do the same. Well, I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm just saying that using two different types of gear is going to give you two different types of results. So if we're talking about that, it's a fine suggestion,
yes,
but you got to have the same kind of results. Jeff?
I don't quite understand where we're trying to get, because what I'm understanding from Dr. Weston is, just use Devil's Bay for example. Every year the Devil's Bay has been open, it has been more and more horses there the next time we go there. Well, every time it's closed, the watermen are gone before it's actually closed, because they didn't caught everything they caught and actually make a living. So I don't understand where we're trying to get there. In all these areas, every area that opens right now and closes, two-thirds of them are caught and done before the closing time comes. And the watermen are gone, so they can't make a living at what they can catch.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is, they're caught up. So if we lessen, all it sounds like we want to do is say, if you catch Jumper's Bay up in 1 week, if you restrict the license and all the other, whatever kind of restrictions, it might last 2 weeks. But in the end, you're going to end up with the same thing. It's going to be caught up to the point that you can't make a living. So where are we really trying to get, other than if you just closed it and then nothing was taken? That's the only way, different thought that you can make. Either way, it's getting caught up. But it's still bouncing back. He hasn't shown us any proof of any area that has gone backwards when it reopened. I don't see where we need to start this catapult of changing things till the graph he shows, the peak is up way high right now, and there's no indication that peak is going to go down next year, other than his telephone survey says that. I think we need to have an area really fall off to before we decide that, oh, we're going to cut the gear license in half, or cut the winter limit in half, because everything seems to be back to this point with no proof that it's not.
It was years ago that when they had the big problem with crabs, they reduced the amount of days that you could catch crabs, but people could still go out there and catch them. And if your objective is that the oysters don't get all caught at one time, that way there's nothing left. They're all caught up before Thanksgiving. There's nothing left. But I just, maybe it's worth considering maybe having one day a week that's normally people can work that they wouldn't be able to work that one day, and not have to reduce the bushels that are caught per man. That way they could go out there and make a living the day they work, because, you know, your expenses, your fuel expenses and boat expenses are so high. I mean, just a consideration.
Well, and something else that, along the note of what Jeff had to say, that I also read in this article that you co-authored back in 2009 with the economic analysis of the management plan of Rappahannock, it is quoted in that article as saying a harvest rate of 50% will leave 50% on the grounds, which, to preface that, it further in the beginning says, in the harvest sector, one half of the mature oysters are taken during the open season, as tends to be the case in this fishery. So it's not an assumption, it's the trend of the fishery, so to be told. Of these, 20% will survive until the next year. Thus, the market stock of oysters will have some positive growth each year as long as the harvest rate is less than 100%. So you're saying now that the harvest rate is 100%, they're going to catch them all up, which is not the case.
Where we get it to a situation, it's making our shells that are the lifeblood of the future go away even faster, because there's so many people working on them on these areas in such large groups that all of them, one of the problems is the shells are not being called off on the areas that they should be on, just because of the amount of people working. And there is damage in all of our stock assessment. We see damage to the young of the year and of the smalls by the harvesting practice, and it varies according to how many people and how long you're on there as to how much damage there is. You see more damage the longer they're there, the longer that you stay in grind with the big numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers on these areas right now are so large that even if we stayed with stocks we have right now, we have too many people working on them.
So take the lessons of that. I think the question that you asked over the past few years has been really what
two or three bad years of spat set, they come through, and all of a sudden, you're at 100,000 bushels, and you've got a lot of people with licenses. Everybody's going to be unhappy because no matter what, we open or close, there's not enough to go around. And I think the big debate that you have here is not through the debates about what's happening on the bottom, is all these fisheries go up and down. What are you going to do when you've got lots of people who bought licenses who come in and are expecting 200, 250, 300,000 bushels and they don't get it?
The same thing carpenters did when the housing boom died in 2008. They found another job.
And you did when all the horses died a while back when they had this plague or whatever.
They found another job.
Somebody got another job.
They bought them up everything at one time. Then you wouldn't have 125 or 150 boats in one little area together.
Mm-hmm. We have hundreds of boats to go over there.
If you had the whole west over, it would last 5 times longer.
Tommy. You showed a couple of graphs for what's projected for this coming year,
mm-hmm.
Which was lower than...
Yeah, which one are you talking
about? Well, we finished any of them.
Yeah.
So that's a standing stock for the areas coming up next season.
Yeah.
Do you have, or can you provide us with similar graphs the last time that it was open? In other words, to show what the difference is then when it was good and what it's projected to be next year.
The ages when there was a harvest.
Excuse me?
The ages of the harvest.
That was a harvest year.
Okay. And the line below it, what's the line below it?
The line below it is one is the number of abortions and one's biomass.
Okay, so that's for this year coming up?
Yeah.
Okay, when was the last time that area was open?
13.
So do you have a similar graph for that to show the difference in change from 2013 to what's coming up? In other words, that would address Jeff's point.
It's right there.
Okay.
I mean, that was one of the areas in the
bay.
Yeah. I mean, you can see that's Temple Bay. We had a harvest there, and then the harvest is coming back up in the next year.
Okay.
So
is what was supposed to be our conservation method. You know, obviously, the Rappahannock and six areas, you've got different acres, different growing conditions. I mean, it's not going to stay the same every year with the rotation, but I thought the rotation was the reason. Conservation method, you know, that's what leaves where the guys can't go there and take those, and hopefully 3 years they're going to come back. Plus, all the sanctuary that we've got. I just don't see either thing you projected here. I just see where the same thing's going to happen. It's going to get caught to the point the guys can't make a living, and then they're going to stop. You can put 50 boats in Temple Bay, and in 2 months it's going to be cleaned up the same as if you put 150 there the first day at home.
That's right.
Either way, it's going to clean up. So what difference does it make whether you catch it 1 week or whether you catch it 2 months? Either way, you've done the same thing in the end when it closed. It's caught up.
Our shell condition is deteriorating faster the more people that we have, which gets back to the replenishment that we can't get enough shells on these areas to keep them up. And then if you don't have shells, then you can't keep the rotation areas.
In other words, we got two problems.
You got two problems you're working
you
with.
No, that's not the two problems. But you were blaming the low harvest, this projected harvest, is because the shells have been eaten up. Y'all said we had low spat set.
Yeah.
Well, if the shells aren't eating up and we still got low spat set, we still gonna have the same problem. We're not gonna have the oysters. Now, we can't make the spat set.
No, we can't. So that's all we're gonna do is
try to get. I don't care where you're coming from, what you're trying to do. At the end, you're gonna get the same thing from happening at the end today.
Tommy.
This is just a note for fellow committee members that. I mean, as far as I'm concerned at this point, I think as we look at this, the 4-bushel limit needs to come off the table. I mean, we've got a recreational harvest of a bushel per person, and these guys have got hundreds of thousands of dollars invested, and we're talking about 4 bushels. I mean, I couldn't pay enough money to make it on 4 bushels. So, where we go with this, in my mind, that's off the table in my consideration. You've got to at least be talking a number that somebody can afford to go out, if not, just shut it down completely.
Yes, ma'am. This is going to be an open process when it comes down to it. Tonight, all we're having is just a discussion about the situation and some of these ideas and concepts. Before August, there will be public notice that will be issued 30 days, 60 days before. There will be ample opportunity.
Public notice is 15 days before the day of the commission meeting. I would suspect the easiest thing to do is let Jim Wesson talk to the commission and go over what happened tonight. Many things could arise from that. Limited entry is definitely something that's not pleasant. It started with striped bass in 1993. It's been with other species that we have as well. It's nothing that anyone looks forward to. So I would hope that what the commission's going to do is ask to have continual feedback, but maybe, I say maybe, even want to sponsor a working group which would involve them, involve the MRC, would involve the industry. So I think the process will be open for the rec that was just mentioned, but it's sort of unknown. I mean, if you remember 3 years ago, limited entry came forward to this committee then, and it really wasn't looked at as anything that was even remotely something that anyone wanted to consider. If you look at the history of what's happened, gone from 23,000 bushels in 2003 up to 530,000 bushels at the time of the public. A lot has changed. A lot of licenses have come in. As Dr. Mann has indicated, we know this is going to be a difficult process, but I think most people here, when you go home, you're going to realize that cult is very important to the future of the oyster industry. And what you're hearing most of the night was, do we have house shells? Do we have dredge shells? Do we have a combination? What should we do? What you should key on is 200 acres needs to be restored with some type of even maintenance shell. The agency's going to be able to do about 500. The commission will ultimately make a decision based on all the information that comes forward. But it is the commission that will make the decision, and this staff, Ben, and anyone else who wants to pitch in, I think that's what it's going to take. But, it's something to go through. We hope it gets done with the least amount of harm to those individuals who have moved into this fishery. And some of the reasons for moving into this fishery is pretty obvious. We've crashed up in Lakewood. That takes care of a little bit of it, although November is really only about 250 to 300 crab top harvesters anyway. So that's not the real answer. There's been movement into this fishery from those who were never in it before. And of course, why not? Because it's been a good resource. So now we have signs that as we turn the corner, things may not be quite as good as all of us would like. So we'll proceed, and if you have internet, send your internet information. If you're not part of the process directly, you will be indirectly. The committee will be directly a part of this, BIMS, the MRC.
So nothing is going to be left to you not knowing the steps that take place. September could be. Jim had said July or August. It may even be, we hope not, as late as September before we know what's occurring here. Strike Bass, for example, did not take 6 months. Strike Bass took a while. It really did. Black Sea Bass, Summer Flounder, Channel Whelp, there are many different limited entries. They're not pleasant. They happen because there literally are a lot of harvesters. I think you know that. 900 and some licensees, you guarantee that a lot of them have been active harvesters that we've never seen before.
Thank you, Rob.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Tommy.
So Jim, what are you for, or what, how do you see this happening as far as our input? I mean, are we going to meet monthly?
I think close to meeting monthly to work this out. Yeah.
Okay. For the next meeting, would it be possible, I think I talked to you about this the other day, to get license history on how many new people are actually in the fishery? In other words, how many new people have commercial cards that have never had history in Virginia's commercial fishery? And how many of those have never had any history at all in the oyster fishery? Hand tonging, hand scraping, hand dredging, whatever.
I mean, we've pretty much done that at least of the 250 that have come in since July.
Okay.
We pretty much got that.
So we've had 250 new oystermen since July.
Since we set the control date in July.
I mean, and of those 250 people, how many are completely new to the fishery? In other words, they came from somewhere else and decided, I want to be a waterman. And they got...
Well, I mean, they may have been a waterman that was in some other fishery and never had done oysters. There's quite a few of them that way.
But haven't there been a... considerable or some people who were just granted exceptions for the 2 year delay.
Oh boy. Okay, let me address that.
Yeah, that's a hard
favorite topic. I think it's about 15%. So let's talk about the 2 year delay, which has existed since 1993, which is misrepresented a lot. I get feedback to that. You can get an exception to the 2 year delay. The amount of exceptions from, let's say, 1999, 2000 to now is like this. Exceptions aren't granted like they used to be. However, think about this. If you are not granted an exception, you can get a transfer. You pay someone, most of you know the going rate, and boom, you're in the fishery. So it's really a difficult process because to figure these people out, which we started on looking at all this information, it's a combination of there are some exceptions that got in, they do go oyster. There are transfers who bought a license, they go oyster. There are plenty of others who did not get in the oyster fishery until recently who were full-time harvesters, mostly full-time harvesters, part-time harvesters. It all has converged in one fishery, and you know what that fishery is. So we can profile that so that you get an idea. But clearly, this is all escalated since 2012.
Well, thank you, Rob. I think we need to get to the bottom to do what we can to protect the full-time people that have been doing this, who have been full-time watermen from the beginning. I mean, when we first got this commercial card, the whole idea of that commercial card was to protect the full-time watermen and allow us to switch from fishery to fishery.
As long as you're here, I'll tell you what I finally developed because I inherited this system. So if you need to get an exception to get into the fishery, then you have to show there was some reason why you could not get in the delayed entry. I forgot to mention that part of the whole situation. So if you say I've worked the water my whole life and you send in your documentation to me, and yes, you've worked for different people, you've never had a license. So Where's the exception if you could have applied for the 2 year delayed entry anytime in the last 20 years, but you did not, and now you want an exception? So appreciate you mentioning that, because if you get in the 2 year delay, you're in. You're just as good as a full-time waterman. You're in the fishery. And in oysters, there's no limited entry. So be careful about what you decide might be full-time fishermen until we show you sort of a profile of who's in the fishery. We did this with blue crab, and some of you know it ended up with a waiting list. We finally found something that everyone agreed to. If you had not harvested any pounds of crab over 4 years, 2004 to 2007, the commission placed you on a waiting list. And 230 people are still there since 2008. So as a staff, we can look at all different types of information so that you have the best idea on who's either historical fishermen in oysters, a recent fisherman, a full-time fisherman. You have to make that judgment on what you think is full-time. Is it worked a certain amount of days during the season? So we are familiar with this. It's going to be a little bit to dig into, but we can do that.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
I just have a question for Jim. Are 900 sets of drugs and straight license, if you're cutting back the license, you want to get back 400. How many of them have two that only need one? Well, they get the drugs. And then how many licenses are not even being used? It's in somebody's pocketbook because I could buy one because I had $300 just to get. All these people in this room are using their license to make a living, going to work, and using them. Is 900 you're looking at every one of them reporting their 8 bushels of oysters?
No, they're not.
That would be a good start. Don't take nothing back from nobody that's making a living with it or using it every day, basically. And that would bring
probably 300. Okay, thank you. Tommy, did you have a comment?
While we've got an audience here, I would like to know the opinion of Cabinet where we're at, the number of licenses we got here now. Is everyone in favor of stopping as a starting place to just no more license, or does everyone feel like anybody should be able to get in it once you get in it? Because what I see is when this word gets out after tonight is a... Ma'am, did you have a comment? Thank you. Yes, sir.
As he was just saying about coming back into the water. He's had a land job. Now he's not going to have a land job. He'd come back more through this year. If he not was right to the one to do it every year, year round, he's sitting on the board.
I'm related. I'm not sitting on the board. I'm sitting on this committee.
All right, you're sitting on there. Is what I'm telling you a lie?
No, it's not a lie. And, you know,
all right, Tommy, you had a suggestion. Was that in the form of a motion?
If it's at the pleasure of the committee.
Good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
can you say the motion again?
My motion would be to cap the scrape licenses, scrape only licenses at the current level as of today.
And what was that number, Jim?
672, but I mean, there could have been some since I did this, and we've been having them come in pretty routinely.
Do you mean cap it at that right now permanently, or until we discuss this more towards the fall?
We could put a sunset on it, or discussion for sunset, a sunset for discussion, not a sunset on that we're automatically at that day you can go apply for a license, but a sunset
so
to
you
have
need
a discussion.
An emergency cap on the hand scrapes,
right?
That would sunset effective today. That would sunset
in maybe August when we come back. And
okay. There a second?
Second.
Any more discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Green. Wake up.
Tommy.
I had one last thing, and this probably isn't going to come off real well at the heels of this discussion, but I would like the committee to consider a 10-day extension of the February seasons because of the weather.
I would second that. That's a motion.
You're suggesting that to go before the commission?
Yes.
Tomorrow. Okay.
Due to the weather and the adversity that we've seen in Tangier, what would we be talking about, Jim? Tangier and York River, that would be? An extension of the February openings for 10 days.
For 10 days, and that's effective, that would be effective as of
March 1st.
10 days in
March. When the ice clears.
It might still be frozen up there.
I mean, you're going to have to put a sunset on it at some point, but yeah.
Is there a second?
Second?
Yeah, second.
Okay. All right, sorry. Discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion passes. Anybody have anything else to discuss in the proposal that Jim put forward or the discussion points? Jim, have anything else?
You want us to look at? I would like to be making progress on this to come back with some stuff.
Yeah. Jim, the mob jack, the area you had set up for the mob jack, does that consider East River, Toe Steak, and Browns Bay? Those are only like 46 acres. It seems small.
Right. Browns Bay, Toe Steak, and Paulson's.
Okay. And all three of them areas would be open at one time?
They were supposed to have been open this past year, but we went back to Area 1. Need to get back on the
You're looking at probably January 1st opening on that, or do some.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Moving forward from here, does staff see a subcommittee to deal with this? What will be, or are you going to formulate something and come back to us? What would be the plan going from here?
This committee wants to work on it as a group. That's fine. I mean, we don't have that many people, so I don't know how much it will get smaller than where we are right now.
Let's see what the commission says tomorrow, too. That will be important. And then I want to add to make sure Tommy Leggett's recommendation, we will profile the harvesters for you so you know things such as, I'll be anonymous, but you'll know bushel thresholds, activity thresholds, things such as that, all lumped into groups.
And you'll be able to give us the number of card exceptions and transfers.
Yes, I already have that through 2015.
Thank you.
Any way to tell whether those transfers did end up as they ordered? Because one of the transfers that just happened that didn't.
Yes,
come
there
out
is.
know there's going to be a lot of digging to find these things, but I think it's very important for where we're at.
We have to link our licensing database with our harvest station.
Jim, do we still need this control date for July 2014 since we just came up with a date today to prohibit any further entry into the fishery?
We just set that date with no stipulation on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go back to if we want to at that date. I mean, this is a different motion. That's actually set of control dates to say no more license after.
Yeah.
After tomorrow or whatever.
Well, I was looking at the numbers, and I know you want to try to reduce it by 400 people. But if you take the 271 that came in since July, that still is not going to not going to.
That's going to get us a 271.
I guess the number
that
we have right now is 5 days
a week. They change it just 4 days a week.
That would
be a big difference. And that way it would stretch out. And they did it with crabs. I mean, I hate it. We used to couldn't work on Mondays. You know, that way the crabs were 3 days old. But on the oyster, he's sitting alive as hell on the bottom.
But you can match the reporting to the user fee. You can match the reporting to the user fee.
But what I'm saying,
they all have gear. They got some gear. That's one.
Yeah.
That's actually the $300 one.
So that's the point.
Are you trying to get the total license down to 400, or are you just trying to get the hand scrape down to 400?
Hand scrape and dredge.
Okay, the total number.
Yeah, not hand-on, hand by hand.
I was thinking just dredge and hand scrape.
That's right.
Any other questions, comments from the committee?
Move forward.
Do you have anything else? Do you have anything else, Jim? No? Okay. Motion to adjourn. Second? All those in favor?
All right.
We'll see where that goes. Yeah.